when they talked to me and when I could do therapy with them, and they told me the people that wanted to speak about their experience, a significant number told me about what I recognized as real mystical experiences in early breakdown, or a sense of everything coming together and, sort of, yes, it all makes sense. And then it all went horribly wrong and they got stuck in the system and that sort of thing. And so I thought there's something going on here. And also, this is the same place.
Hi, I'm Ricky DeRiz. Welcome to episode 31 of the Mind That Ego podcast, where I'm joined by Isabel Clark, a consultant clinical psychologist with 25 years' experience in the NHS. Her books include Meeting Mental Breakdown Mindfully, Madness, Mystery, and the Survival of God, and the main talking point, Psychosis and Spirituality. We explore the similarities between mystical experience and mental breakdown, how the brain filters reality, the fluidity of the self, the mythical nature of transliminal dimensions, the transformative potential of psychosis, why boundaries are essential when accessing non-dual states, and what supports people in crisis on a personal and institutional level. In terms of structuring the dialogue, I wonder if we could begin by looking at how did you approach exploring the overlap of psychosis and spirituality, and what drew you to that field?
Okay, so shall I tell you that?
Please do,
Yes. I've always been interested. I think spirituality, faith spirituality, has kind of always been important to me. And I'm not quite sure why, because the family, I mean, my father was dyed-in-the-wool atheist. He was kind of phobic of anything spiritual. My mother was, much more on that side, but certainly, not in the same way that I was. So an interest in spirituality is something I've always had. Then I studied history originally, and I specialized in medieval history, and I was fascinated by the Middle Ages as a time when spirituality and faith and stuff was important to people. And I was aware how that was denigrated in the society, sort of 50s, 60s intellectual life, not a lot of time for those sorts of things. But when I then got interested in mental health separately, because of the breakdown of a friend when we were in our 20s, I was already sort of not enjoying being a history teacher and, I looking for another direction. So I changed career as a result of that, because I could see from what happened to her. We supported her. She was in hospital for 6 months, and then she actually lived with us for 6 months while she got back on her feet. And I could see that the whole thing just wasn't properly understood. The ways in which it was made sense of sort of led to terrible treatment. And, I wanted to do something about that. So I studied psychology and managed to get into clinical psychology. And while I was studying psychology, I was doing a lot of voluntary work. So I came across psychosis and sort of experience of that. And while I was studying psychology, I was looking for one of the things I was looking out for was the psychology of spirituality. And what I found was that there wasn't really any. So
which is great. There's room to explore.
Right? Yeah, that's right. So I worked it out for myself. And what I came up with to start with was Kelly's construct theory. Have you come across Kelly's construct theory? It's not really in fashion now.
I've seen it through connecting with your work, but maybe an overview of that.
It is about the way in which we anticipate, way in which the mind gets a bank of experience, anticipates things, how we have kind of, it's like a sort of filing system for how we react to things, really. And I thought that probably spirituality was about stepping out of that. That kind of organized things. It made it kind of comfortable and predictable, but it shut out stuff. And spirituality was, and mystical experience and that sort of thing was the experience of stepping out of that and suddenly, wow, you know, you're in relationship with the whole. And I was very interested in mystical literature, and myself and my late husband, we were involved in a sort of contemplative group and all sorts of things. So then I became a clinical psychologist, and I did a lot of work to start with. And when I was doing my training in psychiatric rehab, basically people who had been you know, diagnosed over decades and were really stuck in the system. And when they talked to me, and when I could do therapy with them, and they told me the people that wanted to speak about their experience, they, a significant number told me about what I recognized as real mystical experiences in early breakdown, or a sense of everything coming together and, you know, sort of, yes, it all makes sense. And then it all went horribly wrong and they got stuck in the system and that sort of thing. And so I thought there's something going on here. And also this is the same place as the beyond the construct system. Somewhere in the middle of this, 1995 or so, I bumped into Teasdale and Barnard's work, Interacting Cognitive Subsystems. And this just gave me a better scientific basis than Kelly's construct theory, because Kelly's construct theory is largely theoretical. This was based solidly in research into cognitive, sort of cognitive research into bottlenecks in the brain, what connects with what doesn't connect with what, that sort of thing. And from that, I both, that gave me both a theory of mental health problems, which is essentially what I was looking for, a better one than the existing one. And with the idea of what Barnard talks about, the two main meaning-making systems within the brain, the sort of their connections in the brain rather than chunks of brain, that when they are in desynchrony, you get a different quality of experience. And this was my explanation. And that's, and then I was put onto Claridge, you know, talking to people. I was, in fact, it was my boss at the time who helped me, you know, to investigate Claridge. And he talks about the transliminal. He is, his research is in the dimensions of openness to anomalous experiencing, that sort of thing. And so it was starting to come together. And so in 1998, I decided I wanted to write a book on it. And so I sort of sent a proposal off to, that's right, actually the other strand, which has got completely lost, but which was in that first book and probably explains why they just said doesn't fit into our list, was when I studied history, and I carried on doing evening classes for quite a long time. And I was particularly interested in revolutions. And in a revolution, you get this, the same process happens. If you think of a French Revolution, Russian Revolution, there is a time when it all seems amazing. The people are in charge. Everything's going to be perfect, you know. And then it all goes horribly wrong. And there seemed to be that same in groups. That, and oh, the, actually, yeah, the things that really actually got me going, I think, were, first of all, I'd been intrigued. We'd lived in Germany at the time when the Baader-Meinhof Gruppe were very much there. Mm-hmm. And we'd been students in sort of 68 at the time when, you know, the world was young and there was lots of idealism. And it seemed also there's this sense that that things had kind of, you know, you'd gone from all that wonderful idealism to a murderous bunch of, you know. And I think there was, an extremist thing in America, and an attack on the World Trade Center or something, not the 2001,
mm-hmm.
but something else, in about 1997 or so,
mm-hmm.
Which reminded me of Baader-Meinhof, because again, idealistic people who were sort of living off the land and this, that, and the other, and then they turn out to be, you know, a load of murderers. There's some sort of a switch takes place,
mm-hmm.
and so I was intrigued with this process and wanted to write about it. But my sort of theory of everything book, you know, they weren't interested in that. And then my boss at the time, Paul Chadwick, said to me, and he was the person who put me on to Claridge, said, write an edited book.
Mm.
And that was where psychosis and spirituality came from. Because then, oh, that's right, there was another author who had inspired me, probably prompted me to start writing, was Peter Chadwick,
mm-hmm.
who wrote about his own breakdown experience. And I could see that process that I was tracking was very clear. So I wrote to all these people. I wrote to Peter Chadwick and Gordon Claridge and that's right, In fact, it was Chris, my late husband, who did a bit of research for me, because I was working full time at the time, and found Mike Jackson, who had done research into this. So all these people, I wrote to them and said, would you give me a chapter for a book? And I was in some sort of a charmed space at that point. They all wrote back and said, yes, this is exciting, yes.
Yeah.
So I got this book out of it, and that, you know, has been pretty successful and has had a second edition in 2010, that sort of thing. So at the same time, I was sort of chugging away with my job, and I was working with people with psychosis, but I wasn't really using this stuff yet. You know, probably a bit. But then it was when I got the job I really wanted, which was in an acute hospital, and I was much more in charge of my own fate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd got away from people who really didn't want deviation from the sort of CBT for psychosis orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I applied it to how to talk to people with psychosis, how to, you know, sort of make contact,
mm-hmm.
in a way where you're not imposing a particular way of looking at things. But
yeah.
So does that answer the question?
Yeah, the trouble is I've got so many directions that I want to explore, because I saw you mention, so I'm also someone like, I do relate a lot of like the you know, the collective psyche. Mm. Are you familiar with much of Carl Jung's work?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
And
brought the first sort of psychology that I ever read.
Okay, yeah. Because
quite young, yeah.
What I was intrigued by was, I see similarities in that approach of, I know for Jung, he was working with schizophrenics.
Yes.
When his work, before his work on the unconscious.
Yeah.
And also had that way of aligning like these patterns of behavior with cultural experiences.
Yes.
Did that book get written that you mentioned, like The Theory of Everything, or?
No. I mean, the closest is Madness, Mystery and the Survival of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know that book?
I've not read it, but yeah, I'm familiar with
Oh,
the
I recommend
synopsis.
that one. It's my most readable book, and it's quite fun. Unlike most of my books are rather serious, but they're
Bit of a deviation from the.
and also it is at the heart of it is three accounts by people who had their own, well, two of them I knew through the Spiritual Crisis Network. One got in touch with by another route, but it is very much, based around that. So I think that one would be interesting for you.
So this is what is really intriguing. Like I had a presentation weekend, I think it was last weekend or the weekend before, for ISPS US,
Oh
so
yeah.
International Social Approaches for
I know.
Psychosis. And it was called Metanoia. And in the process of designing the talk, a lot moved through that aligns a lot that with the what I saw in terms of your approach, which I took as a good sign, like seeing that alignment. Also capturing this idea of like you've got a way of filtering reality that is very logical, mostly rational. It's based in the visible realm. And then as you mentioned, like the transliminal space. And in my experience of this, the kind of disintegration into chaos, because you're entering that realm, like you mentioned, like the mystical
You can't
experience.
you can't function properly, yes, in that place.
And like something that what I really like about your approach and something that stood out. So I've been looking at this kind of avenue of spiritual emergency, and I know you mentioned that the network, but also the way that there seemed to be a separation between, well, some experiences are spiritual emergency, some are psychosis, and I could see, yeah, see you shaking your head. This is
Forget
this,
it.
this is it, right? So I want to actually follow that because that was my intuition around it, is like actually you mentioned it as a false dichotomy, and more about how you move through. So I wonder if you could talk to that idea of like the entering that realm and how that can become transformative rather than getting stuck in those spaces.
Yes, I mean it's a sort of possibility for human beings. It's something all human beings can do it to a greater or lesser extent. It's part of you to a lesser extent. It's a part of everyday life. Because most societies have got something like alcohol or quat or something or other that takes you somewhere else. And that's that you need to kind of loosen that very very focused place, and it's a sort of general thing, and indeed, in order to be creative, to be in a flow experience or something like that, then you need to loosen that very tight filter. And where things get seriously stuck, then sort of going along the tram lines is going absolutely nowhere. It's sort of heading for a brick wall. Then actually getting catapulted out of it into that place is a common experience, and sort of high stress and sort of some sort of impossible situation, or indeed things like a lot of solitary confinement, hostage situations, that kind of thing. And if it's kind of if the person has the right support or has the right way of approaching it or something like that, this can be a creative way through, because it can sort of open different possibilities and different possibility. But if everybody around says you're mad and you're given lots of horrible drugs that sort of close it down prematurely and this, that, and the other, it quite possibly, I think the other sort of bit of of my thinking is about the general instability of the self.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite important here, that we have the illusion that we are this unitary self, and our bodies, of course, help to give us that illusion. But actually, I think the self is a sort of work in progress, and it's very easily it's held together by roles and relationships and regularities within our life. When those go, you know, disappear, when we sort of lose important relationships, lose important roles, safety, that kind of thing, then the self has to either repair itself very rapidly or disintegrates, basically. And that's essentially what happens in mental breakdown. So where this stepping into the transliminal enables somebody to draw in something which will help them to recreate the self in a good way. That's the emergence that can be creative, transformative. But where they are told, you aren't, you know, the promising student you thought you were, you are a paranoid schizophrenic and forget about any dreams you ever had. That takes a complete wrecking ball to the self. So it's not surprise. And then where the person tries to work out, you know, I think the underlying sort of process is about trying to get hold of a good enough sense of self.
Yeah.
And if the only good enough sense of self is offered is on the other side of the transliminal, then the person will hang on to that. And a lot of the people in the hospital system who don't take their medication, it isn't because of the side effects, it's because of the main effect. That they don't actually want to lose those experiences. And of course, those experiences are, you know, are enticing and have pluses as well as minuses.
Yeah.
So that's, so there is a possible kind of vicious circle that gets people stuck in that place once they've, you know, had that sort of break experience. Yeah.
It's, and I know you mentioned this as well. It's like you mentioned in one of your papers, like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and like entering the underworld, going into the mythological. I really like as well that articulation of like, and it does tie in with what you mentioned in terms of groups and organizations and this feeling of specialness that arises from that space. But I like the way that you articulate almost like the balance of value that those realms can offer, like be it Messiah complex or just be it a sense of adventure. And
well, that's an illustration of the self, you know, sort of not knowing where it is, you know, sort of grabbing something.
And I think that's what intrigues me. It's like you have the model of, like, you've got psychosis and spirituality, and generally, like, the idea of craziness, or you mentioned in a talk I watched of yours, Crazy Wise, the documentary.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
Phil Borges was on the podcast a few times previously.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
But there is that space of where you're at, really, with this in terms of once you validate that realm as an experiential reality with gifts to bestow and something to integrate, to transform, then you've got another, almost like another set of goalposts where it's like, well, yeah, it's real, it's legit, it has its own energy, it's like, you know, they're archetypal realms. Now there's another challenge in terms of integrating that, and like you say, finding the self.
Well, finding, you know, it's always provisional, the self.
I guess
Finding a good
more of a
enough place, for it. Yeah.
Finding a good enough place, having some kind of center that isn't, like, for me, that's through meditation, like having a center
Yes.
that is more in
Yeah.
awareness
Yeah.
than
Yeah.
like content and movement.
Yeah.
But yeah, the disorientation of that kind of experience, and at the same time, the fact that like the potential for really transformative insight or ideas or movements to move through from that realm, and like balancing the power and the potency of the unconscious, and then also, yeah, navigating that is a really, really tricky terrain. Yeah, and like you said, it has its own process that can be interrupted through medication and stuff like that.
I mean, I'm not saying, I've worked in the hospital for 10 years. I mean, medication is essential, when people are climbing the walls and what have you, but
Of
it's
course.
relied on much too much.
Yeah.
And people aren't given enough choice
Yeah.
in how it's used. It's not always bad, but it's just
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That would be an imbalance to write off medication. Ideally, and this is something I would like to explore as well, maybe in a little bit later on, but just the idea of what kind of environment can support that and provide space to those emergent qualities. I want to, so I'm there's so many things I want to talk about. I'm like, because it really is such a rich vein. I would like to look at, so within this, and actually just relating it to my experience, there are two things you mentioned that I resonate with, and one is the experience of like a oneness, and you already mentioned that with the kind of revolution, a oneness experience and a non-ordinary state of consciousness. This is something that many spiritual seekers, whether they have challenges with their mental health or not, are looking for on some level, be it through psychedelics, be it through meditation. But how that experience can move into, you mentioned here, like an intrusion of the boundaryless experience of psychosis. So this idea, because this is something I've experienced in terms of a oneness experience that then almost amplifies the ego self, or like my kind of self-perception, and brings up a lot of paranoia. And I've grappled with that from, I guess, different levels of consciousness as I've kind of progressed. But I wonder if you could speak to that as an experience of potentially how to navigate, like if you're having an expansive oneness experience, the risk of that then kind of becoming psychosis, and how to navigate those experiences.
I mean, again, this is something we deal with a lot in the Spiritual Crisis Network. And we have standard things that we say to people. And the first one is, entering this space can be transformative, it can be really good, but be careful, it's dangerous. You've got to be able to manage, if you think about the transliminal as going over a threshold, you've got to be able to manage the threshold. You've got to be able to get backwards and forwards. And the way that you do that is by grounding yourself in the present. So, a grounding mindfulness and also in not cutting off from ordinary life, carrying on with ordinary life, boring conversations, doing the everyday stuff, even if there are much more exciting things on the horizon. And if the whole thing, and this is just the advice that we give to people who come, we got a website to make people come in and sort of we're helping them really basically to navigate through this. Yes, if there is any possibility of risk, then they do need to go to the doctor, and they do need to the health services, however deficient, are really the thing to keep people safe. because, you know, if they think they can fly and they go to the top of the multi-story car park or something, you know, and all that sort of thing. So being able to access that place, and then if people are prepared to work at learning skills to manage that. And the thing that that sort of governs it really is high or low arousal. Mm-hmm. That crossing the threshold is most accessible if people are under extreme stress or if they're in a sort of drifting state.
Mm-hmm.
So staying stable means being concentrated on the everyday, the here and now, and being able to always get back to that place. So that gives you a whole lot of tips, really, as to what to do or in a hospital, what to help people to do, you know, and that, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, and what to avoid. If you can navigate that and keep yourself safe, then you can access the transliminal and use its sort of creative potential and this, that, and the other. And that is a different message. That's the message that my sort of program in the hospital or what have you gives, which is a different message from the one that the medical establishment which gives, mm. which is these are horrible symptoms and we've got to squash them at all costs.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? It's like seeing it as part of a wider intelligence, like that transliminal space is part of a wider intelligence of, you know, in Jungian terms, you'd say like the path to wholeness, or just this idea of a greater intelligence to the psyche, that if you can engage and relate to it, there are things to understand. I saw one of your quotes around, you know, even the experience of like hearing voices, for example, in paranoia. And that was something I experienced at one point. Very much, mostly for me, it was like riffing off conversation. So it was just like an extension of a conversation when I'm like, I've left the room, I'm in another space and the conversation's still in my head.
Yeah.
But the empowering potential to, like, for me, inquiring into that allowed me to understand like, well, what is that trying to communicate from parts of me I'm not aware of. And I guess as well, like with you know, this model of if there is a false dichotomy between emergence and you know, what we call psychosis or mental illness, there is always that potential. It's not necessarily, you know, like a rapid transformation into like being able to fully function overnight, but there is a potential to find depthfulness I mean, kind of intrigued as well in terms of, because you meant like a big part of this is like being able to come back to reintegrate into the reality that we share.
Yeah.
How far do you think someone can go and come back?
I don't know. I think an important part of my thinking is that I think we're not in a position to know very much. And that's why the book is called Madness, Mystery and the Survival of God. I think we are intrinsically in a position where, A, we have no grasp of reality. We've got two stabs at it. One is this filtered one where we can actually do an awful lot within a limited context.
Mm-hmm.
And the other where we can, you know, sort of encounter it, wow, but could do absolutely nothing with it. And as human beings, we are not endowed with an apparatus that enables us to know much about reality. I sort of think of, you know, the parallel of how much did the frogs in my pond when I lived in the house with the pond, know about the garden, you know, and planning for planting and things like that. You know, I think we assume that we're just on the edge of tying up all the edges. I don't think we are. I don't think we're anywhere near, you know, I don't think we've got hope.
Well, that's the thing as well, isn't it? Because the language of the transliminal is not, it's not verbal. There's a lot of like deeper intuition. There's a lot of, I know you focus on the felt sense when you work with people rather than the story and interpretation. So there is a need for the ego or the kind of rational consciousness to embrace that mystery from a place of, from a trusting place, from a place of understanding its role in that, I imagine. And that's also part of that kind of finding of the self, or at least having a perspective on the self that is fluid and is
I mean,
able
the
to...
fluidity, I think actually it gives a lot more hope. Because, I mean, a lot of my work is with people who have had pretty severe mental health problems over quite a long time. But if you've got, I mean, you know, quite often they'll just stay stuck. But with an idea of fluidity, it's more hopeful for somebody in that situation than the kind of model that says, well, if you've got this diagnosis, this is all you can hope for. You know, it's all mapped out kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that if people can approach things differently, if they can find different potentials in themselves, you know, if the self is not all set in stone or predetermined, that it's something that can be created out of, you know, whatever potential is out there. It's more hopeful.
Yeah. And that there is, and that creation process is like, it's not all on the conscious function in me.
Oh, no.
Like, it's
no,
like
no,
being
no.
able to, like with dream work, for example, and how these experiences can
absolutely.
Be guides for that process.
Totally. No. My life is organized by dreams.
Oh, yeah, same. Like, I have, a real vivid dream life that is incredibly teaching it does, it calls for humility and kind of seeing the mystery and the not knowing aspect.
And it never gives you straight answers because the transliminal is governed by a logic of both and. So you can't pin anything down. You can't rule anything out.
Yeah, the need to be with ambiguity is a big one, isn't it? And contradiction and uncertainty, and actually be okay in that space. I'd like to look at, so because we're in that realm, but looking at schizotypy,
yes,
as like part of the human spectrum,
yeah,
and as an extension of that, your work with the What Is Real group, because
yes, yeah,
my interest there really is like a really, and just relating this to my talk egotistically, I'll bring that back in, but like this idea of, rather than completely dismiss what we might call a delusion, to be able to meet that as part of the inner experience, whilst acknowledging our external reality isn't as fixed and rigid as we think, and that there is space for, you know, synchronicity and that idea of like an overlap, but in the sense of finding ground in discerning, almost reintegrating the interior so that it's in a more harmonious relationship with external events. So it's not just like I'm Jesus Christ and I can affect reality, but that there is a validity to those inner experiences and the outer. And with that wider expansive framework and kind of integrating the spiritual, how you then work with people in that discernment process. So I think that is crucial. So yeah, that's what leads me to schizotypy and the What Is Real group.
I think it's really a matter of helping people to step back a bit and take a slightly longer view of it. I think the trouble is with the there's the bit of the brain that experiences things, and there's the bit that kind of slots the experience into slots. And in the case of a delusion, that process has got kind of overwhelmed, and the slotting in bit panics when it can't fit the stuff in, and it just comes up with something, and usually something that was salient at the time of the breakdown or something like that. So probably it might be telling somebody something in a metaphorical sort of sense, that it's got like a kind of mythic meaning, but its literal meaning, it needs to, you know, people need to be prepared to sit lightly to explanations and to be aware that the brain is always trying to make sense, to sort of get to navigate a path through the world, basically, in a situation where there really isn't one. And you know, if there are plenty of regularities, you don't notice this because it works absolutely smoothly. But as soon as you step out of the ordinary, it really gets flummoxed. And so being able, I think the Water Trail Group is trying to is sort of taking an interest in these sorts of experiences, getting people to understand, you know, their regularity and which bit they're in, and the fact that some people are more susceptible than to others, but the fact that being very susceptible to them has a good side as well as a bad side, all that sort of thing. And in the What Is Real group, we use the example of David Bowie as somebody who was clearly, you know, a high schizotype, and in fact he had a half brother who committed suicide, and had diagnosed with schizophrenia, committed suicide, but he actually he was a successful businessman as well, you know, performer, and he used all of these weird experiences in his performances and that sort of thing. And you know, that you can be on both sides of the line, as it were.
And schizotypy, if I'm correct, that talks to the tendency, it's to do with openness and the tendency for like you say, anomalous experiences, and there tends to be a link between high creativity and also the risk of like mental illness or psychosis with that as well.
Well, high schizotypy goes along both with vulnerability to psychosis and high creativity, spirituality, sensitivity, you know, sort of valued attributes.
Yeah. Because there is, of course, like we were talking about the self, and I know a common experience of like psychosis and schizophrenia is like, it's not just an inner confusion of self, but outwardly as well, like in kind of, at least talking of my experience, almost the dialogue, the space, the people kind of mix in a way where it was hard to have the center, because it felt like there was like a merging process of me and everything else. So that also...
The boundary goes...
That
I see as the sort of central experience, that the boundary between the inner and the outer, the boundary between the individual and the world, and the protection goes, the possibility of invasion.
Yeah. So there's so many directions I want to go in, but this this intrigues me, because there's a lot of, you know, this idea of, I'll use Alan Watts as an example, but there are a lot of teachers of spirituality that explore that experience of no separation, whilst potentially unintentionally overlooking the need to have, even if there's an expansive experience, a need to have those boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
How
you need both.
both. And that's
I think in one of my I think in a book chapter, I say we are amphibians. We both, we're like, again, the frogs. I'm very fond of the frogs. They hop on the land and swim in the water. We swim in the transliminal.
Yeah.
We sort of, in a less elegant way, we you know, find our way through ordinary life.
Yeah. Yeah. I've like more recently, like the deeper I've got into this, I've started to question, like, if some quite prominent, not necessarily living, but prominent teachers of non-duality actually also had personality disorders. Because you just assume, they got like Maharishi or people like that. You're like, they've got astounding reputations as teachers of profound truth. Yet there's another teacher, I'd name it. It's like Robert Adams. He's passed on.
Right.
I read his content and I'm like, there's an underlying truth, but at the same time, the rhetoric that he often says, which is just like, you are the world, there's nothing else other than you, is more psychotic.
Well, it's both and.
It's both and,
yes,
exactly. Yeah. And
and it isn't the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like there are some of these non-dual teachings don't do the both and. No, they just say rather than this and.
I think when I was sort of getting into this, Ken Wilber was big. I have a major problem with Ken Wilber. I think what happens is because, say, the self is fluid, and this stuff is very seductive.
For sure, yeah.
And also, again, if somebody becomes a guru and everybody's projecting onto them, this kind of distorts the sense of self. Somebody has to be incredibly grounded, not to sort of go off the rails. And of course, many gurus, become dodgy gurus and exploit the situation and this, that, and the other. And I think it goes with the territory because it's so easy to step beyond the boundaries of the self and really not know who you are. And if a whole load of people are saying, ooh, then you're not going to get very helpful feedback.
Yeah, exactly. And it reinforces that kind of significance and also the shared transliminal experience.
Yeah.
Or trance or states meditation.
Absolutely. Well, that's incredibly powerful. I mean, and sort of football terraces, big demos, and sort of anything big.
Yeah.
Takes you into the transliminal.
Yeah.
Anything very big, the very big and the very small. Within a limited context, we're in this joined up shared reality place. Mm-hmm. But once, simply physical bigness, the experience of something like going along a procession with, I think it was the Sheffield Town Giant. And it's a figure of wood and this, that, and the other. But it just has a sort of freaking kind of feeling.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's like we humans have that innate yearning for transcendence. And I know you mentioned this as well. It's like seeing it as a natural thing. It's not like it's not pathology. It's actually innate to human experience. And that can be exploited or it can be utilized with the amount of grounding. Well, one thing that I really appreciate teachers, and like Yogananda is a good example. And even like the structures like Buddhism and Hinduism, they do have constant warnings. They warn the cities around powers that can develop, and like that is not it. I don't want to enter too much into the territory of Ken Wilber and kind of go into that too much, but I appreciate his work, and I also like that he acknowledges the need to wake up, grow up, clean up. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I probably haven't read enough of him. I found him too irritating to read.
He's definitely like an enigma and someone that is bringing a lot together. What I appreciate is he acknowledges in a really relevant way, like what we're talking about, awakening and even self-realization doesn't directly correlate to ethics. It doesn't correlate to emotional maturity, relational maturity.
I would agree with that.
So I think there's this.
I guess what I quarrel with him is the sort of hierarchical nature.
Like the spiral dynamics and
it is always going up somewhere. I say, which I like transliminal. I like a cross.
Yeah,
I am very much an anti-hierarchy person.
Yeah, and like to what degree can that space be integrated? Is a really powerful thing. Like perhaps. Perhaps rather than a hierarchy, that's just innate potential rather than, you know, something to aspire to transcend to, but it's just part of that.
I mean, I think process. Getting good at managing life.
Yeah.
Sing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not, you know, it's not like, it doesn't mean you've climbed up levels, because usually the people that climb up the levels and then they get, you know, then they get, they turn into a dodgy guru, you know.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, so.
And it's like dreams, you know, things, the value of things in dreams, you know, something seems to be terribly good and going well, and then all of a sudden it's really horrible, you know, it can flip, it's unstable.
Yeah And that also links back to that idea of like a oneness experience, or the amount of people now that I imagine are having quite powerful awakenings that initially they're convinced they're enlightened, or that shift has happened, and it is a susceptible space for sure. So I could talk for ages on this and just kind of riff. I want to, like, so we mentioned the What Is Real group, and I know you mentioned within that framework there's like the shared and unshared reality.
And that's the way in which I talk about it in a clinical context.
Yeah,
because it's quite. I found it reasonably easy to sell that, because I could say to people, you know, I get it that for you, this is how you see things, or you are really hearing these voices or having these experiences. Have you noticed that other people don't have those experiences or other people don't agree with you? And generally, almost always they had. And then I'd say, well, you know, as human beings, we don't have access to total reality, but you've got your unshared reality. Then there's a sort of consensus reality, which I'm afraid I tend to go along with. And
maybe we depart there.
then persuade the person that they had to take consensus reality seriously if they wanted to get out of hospital, get off their section, not be put on CDO, that kind of thing.
I think that I'm aware of how I view things, your approach obviously being very, very much like in that field and supporting people. And like this idea that I don't necessarily want to say spiritual rhetoric, because I think it's the potential to be experiential, but the idea of how can I articulate it? Like the consensus reality, or the mainstream ideology of materialism that unintentionally gaslights or potentially minimizes the possibility of even synchronicity. And I mean, if we look at quantum physics now and the amount of work around like the idea of meaning transcending mind and matter, I'm at a point where I'm like, it's really, like you say, it's dangerous territory, and it's hard. You don't want to necessarily engage if someone's like having that disconnect. You don't want to engage with, well, what is reality? And that's what, again, a lot of non-dual teachings do. So I imagine there are people high on the schizotypy spectrum find non-duality and almost reinforce. They don't go through the process of really discerning those boundaries. Then they reinforce, oh yeah, reality is just a dream and an illusion. So I don't have to check.
I mean, but it's like both and.
Both and, exactly. And also, you know, the idea of like consensus reality, a mature way of, even if you disagree, understanding that there is a consensus in terms of how people view certain things ideologically, or even just like what is in the physical space, you know. Like
you've got to be able to navigate life skillfully. Yeah. You've got to be able to, yeah, you know, sort of manage life. Yeah. Otherwise you end up in hospital.
Yeah, that's it.
Not good news.
Yeah. There's a great quote from Ram Dass. His brother was sectioned. And he talks about the experience of going to meet his brother wearing like all his whole outfit, like these beads, talking about God. And he just looks at his brother and he's like, why do you think you're in here and I'm not? Like, we're talking.
Yeah.
Like, there is that overlap.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to make this a bit more tangible, and you mentioned as well, so like working with people, the real importance of understanding like what is shared and what isn't shared in yeah. terms of delusion.
Yes.
How, in terms of the institution, like clearly there are issues in how this is approached and dealt with. What kind of change is ongoing that I'm sure you're a part of, but also what more could be done to make the shift and to create the environment that would really support people in these situations, regardless of culture, regardless of their own, their background, for it to have, I guess, the best chance possible to be transformative and not to get stuck. What changes would you like to see? And what are the issues that you would like addressed?
The way that I approach it is by saying, let's start from the inside. Let's see human beings as people who, have to feel okay inside. You don't notice it if you do feel okay inside, though. We spend all our time sort of adjusting it. You know, we have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, or we listen to some music or something, you know, to change our... we're always titrating how we feel inside. And that's sort of the background. And where people don't feel, you know, where it goes seriously haywire, people will do something in order to make themselves feel better inside, or in order to try and get it into some sort of homeostasis. They might go to bed and not get up. They'll be diagnosed with depression. Or they might spend all their time worrying. They're going to get an anxiety disorder. Or they might click off into another dimension, so they got psychosis. There's a whole load of ways in which they can do this. So what I'm trying to do in, you know, where I'm teaching staff groups and that sort of thing, is to get the staff group, to everybody, you know, from the, the senior nurse down to the healthcare support worker, to see the people in their care as people who are trying, struggling to manage how they feel inside. The complicating thing, which makes it difficult for people to straightforwardly empathize, is that there's a time dimension, and earlier trauma, when the chips are down, earlier trauma comes into the present. The time goes out the window. So, you know, human beings are intrinsically somewhat unstable because of this. So to get that sort of accurate empathy in every member of staff, so that their job is to help the person to see what's happened and to support them to manage how they feel inside in ways that don't keep them stuck, because going to bed and not getting up will keep you stuck. Carrying on worrying about it will keep you stuck. Shutting yourself away, not going out, will give you more time to turn it all over in your head, you know. So you've got to find it. It's going to be really challenging, because there's a really good reason why you don't want to go out. It's just too terrifying. But, to support people to manage their feelings, to do those things. So that is really where I see. And, you know, medication can have a role in that.
Mm-hmm.
in enabling people to feel good enough inside that they can function. But it's not going to solve anything. So they've actually got to take on board what's happened and to do something about it. And I call that comprehend, cope and connect. They've got to understand what's happened. They've got to cope in a different way. They've got to connect both with themselves. As the other bit of this is that the relationship between a person and themselves is key. And usually people who land up in the system are treating themselves badly.
Yeah.
They've got to start treating themselves as they would treat somebody else, you know. Simple as that. So the sort of connection and the other connection is the general pressure from the world around. Where that's intolerable, then somebody's going to break down, you know? And that certainly got worse and worse in last 20 years or 15 years or so.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to achieve. What pulls in the other direction is a narrative that says we've got to, these people are ill, they've got this illness, we've got to find out which illness they've got. And when we know which illness they've got, we know whether they're likely to get better or not and what medication to give them.
Yeah.
And that is the expert has the power then, and the person can sit back. And they don't have to worry about looking at their impossible relationship or, you know, sort of putting the effort in to leave the flat. If they don't ever want to leave the flat, they just need to take the medication and somebody will fix it. So, in fact, what, you know, what I want people to do is tougher in a way.
Yeah, but ultimately that's what is going to lead to the transformation, right?
It's like that's going to give them a chance. And underlying it is the idea that we are not as fixed as we think we are. So that anybody has got potential in them that's probably untapped.
Yeah.
And they need to start tapping it. And their strengths and sort of, you know, finding out their strengths and looking at them as a whole person is another side to it.
You mentioned like the relationship with the self as well. And I know for me, practicing loving kindness was probably
that's
the biggest, because there's that. I was talking to my partner, Sanya, the other day, and I mentioned scenario making as a term, which I don't know if I made up. I was sure that it was a psychological term in terms of joining those dots and how that links to paranoia and psychosis and like interpretation.
No, I think I know what you mean.
And for me, the experience of meditation, not only offering refuge, but loving kindness is such a powerful way to dissolve the mind's tendency to fill in the blanks, to like project into the abyss, and actually to just be like, almost paradoxically as well, accepting what if these scenarios are true, but in a way of just peacefulness rather than like, I've got to adapt. You mentioned that, like the need that all humans have to some extent to change their state, but actually to be with the uncertainty, to be with that ambiguity.
You can never have total control.
Yeah,
because the other thing people try to do is to control, and in relationships they try to control. And if you accept the fact that you can't have any control.
Yes.
There is no control.
Yeah, that's huge. That's not huge. Yeah.
And you can have relative control, but not absolute control.
Yeah. Yeah, letting go of that. Because for sure, like, at least talking to myself, there's a narcissistic, neurotic element to it in terms of, I believe that function is energized by the desire to control how you're perceived by almost anyone, so that there is
of course, we all want, I mean, in how we're perceived by others has a major impact on how we feel about ourselves.
Yes.
How we feel inside.
Yeah. With, like, so you have that, like, with the working within the field, like, you have that relationship of working with the people, working with those struggling and like changing their approach to it with more kindness. How, like, say for example, there's someone who's really embedded in the system, had a lot of reinforcement in terms of being mentally ill, perhaps institutionalized for a period of time. How would that approach apply to someone like that? I guess it would be similar, but perhaps more. Like how would you approach that, someone who's, I guess, been in the system for a while?
I worked in psychiatric rehab for 12 years. So, I worked with a lot of such people. And, for some people are not going to change. They're not going to come out of their shell. It feels too frightening to do so. And other people will, pick up some of it. And for other people, it can be really important, and they really can sort of step out of it. So I've seen all.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it is up to the individual how much they can do. And there is also different sorts of damage. I mean, there's physical damage, there's brain damage, there's things which can make it more difficult for people to be flexible. Whether it's fear or whether it's some sort of cognitive deficit or something like that. So, it's just a matter of trying one's best with, and finding, getting a list of people's strengths and their potential and that kind of thing is central to my way of working. So just working with whatever, good bits, sound bits you can find, and helping the person to have a different vision of themselves. If they've been stuck in the system a long time, they might be, have a sort of hopeless vision of themselves, but to be able to see themselves as someone who can, could take a bit more control of their own destiny in a small way.
Yeah.
Because again, we have no control over the people we work with.
Yeah. Well, it's embracing the mystery of that as well. Like, on a deeper level, what is it within someone that, allows them to make that choice or make that decision? Like, they're big questions that are really hard to.
Yeah, you've just got to do your best to try and bring that out, whatever it is, and that and a sort of bit of hope and stuff.
Yeah. What would you, and I think we're already touching upon it, but what would you say if there was someone listening or watching this dialogue and they had started to experience, like, within that anomalous experience, more in the realm of psychosis in terms of hallucination or hearing voices. And I know for me, like, so much fear was present with that experience. What would you say to someone if they were in that, they were starting to experience that, or they'd been in the throes of it and maybe or maybe not sharing that? What would you say?
I'd say bring yourself back into the body. Notice the body. Notice what it feels like to breathe. Look around. Really see your surroundings, really as if you've never seen them before. Bring yourself into the present moment. And then notice the fear. Where do you experience the fear? What is fear? Well, it's, tightening of the muscles, it's shortening of the breath, So, okay, fear, then it's the body getting ready for action, because in evolutionary terms, we've been designed to survive sort of wandering around the savannah along with lions and what have you, so you know, to run fast, get out of the way quickly and that sort of thing. But is that really useful at the moment? Are there any lions? Do I need to tense up? Or to breathe short, maybe breathing out long, switch off the body. That's the approach I take to that.
Very, very much, because I know mindfulness plays a big role in this.
It's grounding mindfulness, bringing down arousal.
Yeah.
And then taking hold of the attention and focusing on something in the present.
Yeah, so important, isn't it, to kind of
Get into the body.
get into the body. Yeah, this links to the trauma side of it as well, and
No,
like,
notice what the body's up to and tell it to stop.
there's a lot to reflect on. I think for now, I say for this conversation, I'm really hopeful that we'll talk again.
No, that's fine. No, we've been talking for over an hour. It probably is
What
time to wrap it up.
it's I always find this, right? Like, we're doing the podcast, there's like that the li like holding the awareness of people listening. But for me personally, and just for my experience, like, I'm not only thankful for the work that you're doing, but inspired by it, because I know, there could be a feeling of like disenchantment, disillusionment, going through a process that I've gone through. I was lucky I wasn't institutionalized or anything like that. But yeah, my again, my partner Sanya, she's got a close friend who's been institutionalized for a long time. And what is quite sobering is seeing the similarities between us and that just divergence. But it really gives me a lot of hope, the work that you're doing. And I'm so grateful for that. And long may it continue. I think this is just absolutely essential. And yeah, thank you for
Okay.
that.
And I just say to anybody listening to the podcast, do try and get hold of Madness, Mystery, and the Survival of God. It's on my website, how to.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and is your website is
It's isabelclark.org.
.org, and you
And
mentioned,
Isabel spelt with an A and an E on the end of Clark.
yeah, I'll put links in the show notes as well. You mentioned psychosis and spirituality. That's another one of
I mean,
your books.
Psychosis and Spirituality is the book with the research in it. So it's an edited book, and you can probably get that from the library. Madness, Mystery, and the Survival of God is a small paperback, which is highly readable.
10 out of 10, 5 stars on Amazon.
Well, I probably not, but I'm no good at sort of any of this kind of marketing stuff.
Oh
I'm
no,
just
great.
doing my
We'll
best. Yeah.
put links into that. And thank you so much for taking the time and joining
Okay,
me
no,
today.
it's been good fun. So good luck with your work.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.